well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. As promised, we're going to be sitting down with ATF Director Robert Sakata today. The director in Wichita, Kansas, will talk about why that is the case. And I will tell you right up front, did not have a chance to answer or to ask all of my questions. So we will be continuing this conversation in the near future. But we did address a number of topics, including the case of Patrick Tate Damiak, the accusations that we've seen from gun control groups that the ATF is essentially now a wholly owned subsidiary of the gun lobby, and more. We got started talking about why the director is on a road trip. Take a look and a listen. Director Sakata, thank you so much for joining me on the program. It's good to see you, sir.
Good morning, Cam. Good to see you as well.
And you were not in D.C. today. You were in Wichita, Kansas. And we were talking before I hit the record button. What are you doing out in Wichita? There's a particular lab there that the ATF has?
Yes, sir. We opened up on Monday the Forensic Crime Gun Intelligence Laboratory that is now the third ATF lab in the country. One we have in Maryland and Amondale, the other in Atlanta, Georgia. And this laboratory here is specifically focused on our expertise in the area of crime gun intelligence, which is E-Trace, NIBIN, which is the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network, and DNA. And I know most people will say, well, ATF didn't discover DNA. Law enforcement uses DNA. True. What ATF did do was they created a way to preserve the evidence that's left on scene after a shooting or a murder. Fired cartridge casings are left on scene. A firearm is dumped on the streets. And often it's exposed to the elements. Rain, other people may have touched the firearm, other debris that's in the street. And the process to recover DNA has changed significantly. If I go back to 2017, when I was a assistant special agent in charge in Philadelphia, we were telling people, don't worry about DNA, because the ability to recover DNA from a fired cartridge casing or even a firearm, we only had success in less than 2% of those attempts that we were trying to recover a usable DNA profile. Since that time, the methods that our lab put in place to try and recover and preserve the evidence so we would have a better chance of getting more DNA, significantly improved our ability to get DNA, a usable profile that we can submit for examination and also to submit into CODIS. So that less than 2% has now gone up to 70%. Which is tremendous. So DNA, yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, we were talking about sort of this targeted deterrence approach, right? I mean, and you recognize that, you know, vast majority of crime committed by a very small number of individuals in any given community. You were telling me again before we hit the record button about your experience as a police officer in New York City, kind of flooding the zone where, you know, a bunch of shootings were happening. Engage in the stop and frisks, and you know, people who were not violent criminals feeling like they're double victims, right? They're victimized by the gang members and the drug dealers in their community, and then they're victimized by the police coming in and treating them as if they're violent criminals. I hadn't really thought about, you know, forensic evidence helping this targeted deterrence approach, but it sounds like you are very much able now to get a better idea. Okay, who are the bad actors in any given community based on the DNA profiles that you're able to retrieve from these firearms and even from casings?
Yes, sir. So, yeah, that's correct. Again, during my days on patrol or to a specialized gun squad in New York City, I was part of the NYPD street crime unit back in the day. And we were very much focused on trying to reduce violent crime in these communities affected by gun violence, shootings and murders. We had very limited tools. Yes, we knew how many shootings occurred, how many people were victims of shootings. We had no idea who was conducting those shootings. And yes, there were gangs, some of which we had identified, others we were working to identify. But today, back then, When we would go into a community, we would go with our team, originally consisted of about 100 really brave and really professional law enforcement officers, working late at night, 8 to 4 in the morning many times, trying to minimize impact on folks that were traveling to and from work and caring about their business. But nonetheless, without having specific intelligence as to who may be involved in these crimes, you're involved in conducting traffic stops and pedestrian stops and engaging people in a discussion. And whether people believe it or not, it was actually not stop and frisk. It was stop, question, and frisk. And you try to determine, why is this person in this area? Where are you going? Where are you coming from? And as good as you could deliver that message, people felt wrong. People felt that, hey, why do I have to explain to you where I'm coming from or where I'm going? I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm a good citizen. I'm not a criminal. The criminals are causing the problems and you're stopping me. Why are you not stopping them? And the big answer was, we didn't know who they were. We were working our way through these processes to try and identify them. There's a much better way to do this today. And we've significantly improved that in the years. And it is all three components. It's the three legs of the stool are trace data to help us understand where these firearms are coming from, if they were trafficked to that area. NIBIN, which is the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network, is tremendous because it'll tell us if the same firearm was used in multiple shootings in a particular neighborhood or sometimes from one part of the city to the next city. We've also seen firearms used, for example, on the U.S. side of the border are used to commit shootings and murders, and they're also used by cartel members in Mexico to kill people in Mexico. NIBIN helps us identify where we need to put our people and the likelihood of where these folks will be conducting violent crime. DNA takes it a step further. The processes that our folks put in place have increased the likelihood that we will be able to retrieve a DNA profile off of a fire cartridge casing or from a firearm to almost 70%. What that tells you on a firearm, for example, we're also able to tell you if more than one person's DNA is on that firearm. Up to 4 different profiles could be identified, which was not able to be done years ago. And many labs around the country are still not at that level. ATF is training them, helping to fund equipment that they need. But bottom line, most labs are only able to tell you if there is a one DNA profile. If they have more than one profile, it'll say DNA mixture, inconclusive results. That can cause a problem in the courts because it presents an alibi for a defendant to say, well, it wasn't me. Somebody else had custody of the firearm. Mm-hmm. When the process we use now, I can say, Cam, not only did your DNA come up on that firearm, but it was on the trigger, the front sight, the back sight, the slide, the grip, the magazine well. And not only that, when you took the firearm apart at one point, your DNA was inside the firearm as well. So it really eliminates the argument of that defendant or suspect not being involved in the crime as they were trying to distance themselves. And also the margin of error is so significant. It's like 1 in 650 quadrillion that it wasn't you if you're identified. So when we go to court with those cases very often are damning evidence presented before the courts and a jury. And those are ones where we actually are very successful in holding somebody accountable for committing a violent crime. And when they get a significant sentence, that serves as a deterrent for other people who would consider participating in a crime like that.
Yeah. You know, and there are a lot of areas I want to talk about during our conversation here, Director. But, you know, you talk about ATF investigations and sentences. I want to ask about Tata Damiak's case. I know that you were asked about this at the House Oversight to Judiciary Committee hearing last week, and you did say that the you were aware of this, that there are DOJ officials who are aware of this the case itself, as well as this, you know, a diesel therapy that he supposedly was going to be subjected to. Lee Williams from the Second Amendment Foundation investigative reporter has said that there were ATF officials who actually got involved in ensuring that that Tata Damiak remained in his current location before he is transported to Virginia for a resentencing hearing coming up in a few weeks. He wrote an open letter to you. Have you had a chance to read Tata Damiak's letter?
Yes, sir, I have.
And what are your thoughts? Do you have anything that you would like to share with him publicly?
I think that the challenge with Tate Adamiak's letter is, we obviously he has an appeal pending, and we are. I don't want to be in a position to damage his efforts on his appeal or put the government in a bad position with my comments on that. I don't know the case, nook and cranny. I didn't investigate the case, but there's claims that Tate makes where the government doesn't agree. Bottom line, Tate's case went to court, and Tate was convicted in a court. I think that the biggest challenge is the sentence that Tate received is a sentence I've not seen for a case like that. I've seen cases where folks with no criminal history are involved, and I'm not saying Tate. I'm not using any of my statements towards Tate negatively, but for example, I personally charge people for trafficking or dealing in firearms without a license, and they were dealing firearms to gang members, no criminal history. We charged them. They went to trial. They got 3 years in jail. Right. The sentence was based on sentencing guidelines attached to some of the firearms, specifically, I believe it was M79 grenade launcher and an RPG tube that was not inert as it was supposed to be, but it wasn't completely inert. And these are areas of the law that are, although they're technicalities, and most people don't understand how these technicalities put them in opposition with the law, and frankly, put them at risk of being convicted of a crime. Some of these things are, I believe, need to be clarified for the public, right? And it's not a game, right? We don't want to see anyone get in trouble or be sentenced to any sort of prison time if there's any lack of clarity of what something is. And I think with these particular devices, you can argue with what stage they were in, but bottom line, from what ATF folks have told me, that they were not properly demilled and ultimately very easily reassembled to fall within what the law would call a machine gun or a readily convertible RPG or M79 grenade launcher. And that's a challenge, and I get it. And I understand there's a difference of opinion in both the courts. I'm sorry, not the courts, but in from Tate's perspective and ATF's perspective. Look, for me, my perspective is this: ATF looked at this. We provided our perspective to DOJ. They're looking at it as well in a review. I don't want to speak on DOJ's behalf as to what their thoughts would be, but there is a resentencing coming up, and from my perspective, obviously Tate has an appeal that is moving forward, and we are not offended by the outcome of whatever happens in the courts. But what we would like to make sure is whether someone is convicted or not, we want to make sure they are convicted of the crime that they actually committed and appropriately sentenced. When Tate's getting 20 years and we have people that are committing violent crimes and they're not even getting a fraction of prison time like that, there's a big problem. And I think that ATF will do a better job at stressing to folks the risks that they take when they're building some of these firearms, especially not having their proper authorities to do these items that are classified as destructive devices, because the sentencing guidelines on those devices is what actually put Tate in a category that created the most jeopardy for him as far as exposure in prison, not the actual firearms.
And again, I'm not gonna litigate the case itself, but I do appreciate your candor in talking about the concerns that you have with the sentence that he received. But this brings me to something else that that came up during the House Oversight Committee. There were a number of Democrats who insinuated or outright insisted that these proposed rules that the ATF has put forward are designed to benefit the gun industry, that the ATF is now controlled by the gun industry. What is your response to that? I mean, we heard Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche say that you shouldn't need a law degree to understand ATF regulations. Were these rules and regulations put in place to benefit the firearms industry, their bottom line? Were they put in place to minimize the risk of gun owners going to prison for violating federal law, or was the intent, as the acting attorney general said, to make sure that these rules are clear, bright, understandable, without having to get attorneys involved here?
Cam, I think without speaking for the acting attorney general, he was spot on. Bottom line, when we as ATF agents had confusion, in particular, the stabilizing brace, right? That particular item went back and forth in many areas as to what's a short barrel rifle or not. And when agents don't understand exactly where that falls based on an accessory attached to a firearm, in our position on that change multiple times over a 10-year period, what's our option? We are not taking enforcement action on something when me personally, I am not telling myself or my folks to take enforcement action on something we don't know where we stand. If the government doesn't understand exactly where we stand, how the hell does the public understand? How do you hold people accountable when there's a back and forth perspective as to what is or isn't the problem? And I use the stabilizing brace as an issue because, for example, under the last administration, I purchased several firearms, two rifles and a shotgun that were equipped with stabilizing braces. And the shotgun in particular had the most, I think, confusion because of the definition and what a shotgun can and can't be. Bottom line, I registered them at the time because, hey, I didn't want to run afoul of the law, especially being as a being an ATF agent. But I was pretty upset when I was told that I did something wrong. I didn't do anything. I bought a firearm from a federal firearms licensee, did all the paperwork, paid the tax in the state that I lived in Florida for the firearms I purchased too. And then I was told, well, you were supposed to pay a tax to the NFA because of having these short barrel rifles. I said, hey, that's BS. We didn't put out the clear guidance to these folks over the years. I bought these through a legal market, did not attach any accessories on my own. And now you're telling me I did something wrong and I have to actually register and pay a tax. I was very upset with the team, and I voiced that to the prior leadership team here and prior counsel's office. But, hey, I was in a position where I couldn't sway their decisions, but they knew clearly where I stood. The bigger problem on all this is there's a theory that these firearms, if you own one of these firearms, you only own it to go kill people. I can assure you, I've owned these firearms now for about 8 years. I haven't killed anyone with any of my firearms. And bottom line, I've never killed anyone or shot anyone in my capacity as a law enforcement officer or a civilian. These types of statements are not helpful to either side of this discussion, right? When you identify a firearm with a person as that person being evil because they possess or own a firearm legally, it's a remark that where you lose the forward progress in a conversation. And that's where they lost me. This is not something that was helping the public. As law enforcement officers, we look at trace data, right? Trace data tells us a lot of things. Where a firearm comes from, the time to crime from the time that it was first entered the market till when it was used in a shooting. It also tells us the types of firearms are used in violent crimes. Sure, could a rifle with the stabilizing brace be used in a violent crime? Yes. Has a rifle been used with a stabilizing brace? Yes. Has that number reached the same number of, for example, pistols or revolvers? No. Handguns are still chosen by criminals and prohibited persons to be used in violent crimes. Rifles and short barrel rifles fall way over to the far end of the column as the lowest number of firearms being used in violent crimes. And again, not to say that they can't be, but to just say that piece of accessory that's attached to that firearm now is identifying it with mass murder. And if you possess that firearm, you're a killer. I think that's an argument where you lose all support of anyone willing to talk about how we proceed in making the public safer.
I think you're absolutely right about that. So to that end, I mean, you talk about how you tried to push back against this rule, but you weren't in a leadership a role at that point in time. Now that you are obviously in a leadership role, now that you're the top dog, we've seen, again, I think a number of these proposed rules that have been introduced that that will be of benefit to gun owners. I'm particularly pleased to see the new proposed regulation on how FOPA is interpreted. And, you know, folks can stop and get their car repaired if they need to. They can stop overnight in a hotel without having to worry about getting arrested. On the investigation side of the agency, you know, again, going back to Operation Fast and Furious, I mean, you could go back to Ruby Ridge if you wanted to and Waco. But even, you know, the ATF sting operations in places like Milwaukee, the ATF raid on the home of the airport executive in Little Rock, there is a belief, I think, among a lot of gun owners that the ATF is overly aggressive, that they do have a gotcha attitude towards gun owners. Have you seen anything in your time, either in leadership or not in leadership, on the investigative side of things that you want to change now that you are the director of the ATF?
Cam, you mentioned a lot of things that go back a long time, right?
Right.
You know, for
example, including a lot before you were even with the agency, and I understand that.
Correct. And, you know, look, I think it's important to not forget about those things, right? Because we do have lessons learned from all of those incidents. And to be frank, so do many other federal law enforcement agencies. And it seems that some get a pass on this stuff, and we shouldn't get a pass. I don't want a pass. I want to learn when we've done a lot. I mean, I'll go back from Waco. There was a lot of mistakes that happened there in the tactical side, the planning side, communication internally, all sorts of stuff went wrong there. And we made a lot of changes over the years based on Waco. Fast and Furious, I would like to address in particular. First of all, Pete Roselli and I are very good friends. We work together now. I've known Pete 35 years. We were housing cops together.
One of the whistleblowers in the Fast and Furious.
Yeah, Pete and I were housing cops together in New York City. So, you know, we go back a long time. He's a straight shooter. Fast and Furious, as Pete has told you, there was mistakes on the ATF side. But one of the biggest mistakes that we had was the prosecutors in Arizona, in particular at the time, refused to prosecute these cases, right? So all of this led to agents trying to figure out, okay, how are these firearms getting to Mexico? And they're tracking serial numbers, they're tracking sales after they happen through NICS alerts and all sorts of other things. But the guns were gone already. The guns were gone into Mexico. Okay, everybody knows what happened in Fast and Furious, but bottom line, the prosecutors didn't let us do our job and refused to prosecute those cases. Fast forward to the Biden administration. The same prosecutors that were in play in Fast and Furious now were in executive leadership positions at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Arizona. Gary Restaino, former ATF director for a very short time, was a U.S. attorney. His first assistant and crim chief were the same people that were refusing to prosecute gun cases in Arizona during that time of Fast and Furious. So we have agents, and this is all supported by fact. We have agents in Arizona that were working on some great cases during the Biden administration, focused on firearms trafficking, going to Mexico, right? Nothing's changed. The cartel was still trying to source guns from some of the places in Arizona. Our folks identify through really great investigations, approximately 200 or so defendants, maybe 250, I call them defendants, but they're actually suspects. People we were looking at for trafficking. Some of these cases were so blatant where we, for example, had a female, 5'6", 120 pounds, purchasing, you know, almost two dozen belt-fed firearms, none of which she knew anything about, paid cash in the area of $450,000. We find out from other FFLs that, hey, this is something going on around this business here. You should take a look at it. We end up doing our own investigation and do an interdiction, stop that female suspect, her partner or associate, who they both admit and identify a cartel member that they were working for, sourcing firearms on behalf of the cartel. Very good statements provided. No intention or charge these people, right? So they get cut loose, not because ATF didn't want to charge them. Federally, it's different than when I was a cop. You commit a crime in front of me when I was a cop, I slap the cuffs on you, you go into the system. The state takes over then. But federally, I can't arrest you unless we have support from the prosecution team to move forward and take that case forward. So now we let these folks go back out on the street because I don't have any support to charge them, right? Now, just think about what deterrence happened there, right? The cartel just learned that ATF's not able to charge these folks. How many other people do they have doing that? So I told you we were looking at about 250. So we suffered about a year. We went to that office, myself and the team, and I will say the former director went there as well and said, hey, what's going on? Three times, no effort to move forward and charge anyone. We then get into this administration, and the first thing we did was talk to Todd Blanche and his team, and I presented a stack of these cases. I said, here are the receipts, right? We have a big problem coming on our hands. We are going to have Fast and Furious 2, because these firearms are making their way into Mexico, because despite our efforts to charge, yes, we're interdicting firearms, but nobody's getting charged. And this is how we got to the place we were in Fast and Furious. The administration took a different perspective. They reviewed all the cases, prioritized. Obviously, out of 200, you got to figure out which ones are the bigger threats, and we have to hit them a group at a time. They immediately went after one of the FFLs, which has publicly been presented. It was Grips by Larry in Arizona. Dirty FFL, complicit in trafficking firearms to Mexico to include belt-fed firearms. And they were the first case that we were able to charge folks involved in this conspiracy with providing material support to a terrorist organization. ATF is not.
This case could have been brought under the previous administration, but the U.S. Attorney would not do it. Director, unfortunately, we are almost out of time here. I've got a hard out here in just a couple of minutes, and I have so many more questions for you. Can I invite you to come back on the show the next time? You can carve out another half hour or so.
Yes, sir. One thing I'd like to note is we're always welcome to talk. Look, there's not always going to be something we may agree upon, but I'm always going to be candid and make myself available for you or anyone else that would like to speak to us.
Well, I really appreciate your time today. And I have to say, you know, having looked at the proposed rules, I think that the vast majority of them are going to be good for gun owners. I don't think that is the intention to get to chummy with the firearms industry. But again, I don't think I think it's been pretty clear that you don't view the firearms industry as an adversary, that you view them as partners in taking down violent criminals, taking down gun traffickers, which I think is a very different approach than what we saw under the previous administration. Director Robert Sakata, again, I really appreciate your time today, and I look forward to continuing this conversation in the very near future.
Thank you, Cam. I appreciate your time as well.
My thanks again to ATF Director Robert Sakata for joining us on the program. I am looking forward to continuing this conversation in the not-too-distant future. I will also be talking, hopefully in the very near future, with ATF General Counsel Robert Leiter, where we'll get a little bit more in-depth in talking about these proposed rules, some of the issues with the rules that were put in place under the Biden administration. But again, appreciate Director Sakata for carving out a few minutes today. Before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, let's talk about this for a second. From city streets to mountain trails, your gear should go wherever life takes you. And that is why, at Modern Rugged Leather, every bag is handcrafted from premium, responsibly sourced leather. It's designed to look sharp, last long, and tell the story of its own. Every stitch, every buckle, every strap reflecting timeless craftsmanship, and it's backed by a lifetime warranty, because quality shouldn't quit when the adventure begins. So whether it's the boardroom or the back roads, Modern Rugged Leather helps you carry confidence every step of the way. And if you are looking for a Father's Day suggestion as a gift, or maybe you're looking to give a Father's Day gift, I highly recommend Modern Rugged Leather. Modern style, timeless durability, and backed for life. Life takes you places. Make sure your gear keeps up. And you can shop the full collection and find yours today at modernrugged.com. Again, that's modernrugged.com. All right. On to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a case out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Man arrested on weapons probation violation charges in Pittsburgh. As it turns out, this individual had an active warrant out for his arrest. Well, actually, two active warrants out for his arrest. One, because he decided to stop complying with the terms of his probation. 20-year-old Jermaine Strong, taken into custody last Thursday morning at a home in the Sheridan neighborhood of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He was declared a fugitive earlier this month when a bench warrant was issued for a probation violation connected to a 2024 guilty plea to a single count of robbery. Now, I don't know what the original charge was, but I'm sure it wasn't just simple robbery. You don't take a plea deal to the charge that you were originally charged with, right? You're looking for something better. You're looking for a reduction in charges, a reduction in sentence, and that is what Mr. Strong received. So we don't know if he got any jail time, any prison time, but regardless, already out 2 years after this guilty plea for robbery. There was another, though, active warrant that had been issued from the city of Pittsburgh charging Strong with pointing a gun at and threatening a woman and her infant child as they stood on a street in downtown Pittsburgh. Don't know if there were any relationships between Strong and the woman in question, but again, he had an active warrant out for his arrest in that incident. Detectives developed information that Strong was inside a home there in the Sheridan neighborhood. They got to that home Thursday morning. We were able to take Strong into custody without incident. He was transported to the Allegheny County Jail, where at last report, he is still behind bars. But who knows for how long that will be the case. Today's armed citizen story from Eugene, Oregon. Don't have a ton of information here, but we do know that this attempted burglary turned into a shooting. Both the burglar and the homeowner firing shots in this incident, according to local news. Registered guard reports that this was May 19th. Man reported to police that someone had broken into his home and was shooting, and he was returning fire. So it sounds like he was able to get a hold of his phone while the gunshots were, taking place. Officers arrived. They found two individuals with gunshot wounds. They immediately rendered emergency medical help until the Eugene Springfield Fire Department paramedics arrived, transported the individuals to a local hospital, guessing one was the burglar. One was the homeowner, or maybe a resident of the home. Police say an investigation is ongoing, and hopefully we'll have more details on this incident here in the days to come. But we hope that the homeowner is going to be okay, and glad that they were able to protect themselves, at least in the immediate term, from this, I'd call it a home invader, honestly. I mean, at that point, when shots are fired, it's not just a simple burglary. There's more to the story than that. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing, able to do the right thing. A good Samaritan in San Mateo, California, able to come to the aid of a hiker by performing CPR on this individual. This was Monday afternoon, about 4 p.m. There was a bystander, well, maybe somebody who was out on a hike of their own, saw a guy face down on a trail at Coyote Point. In full cardiac arrest. Now, he was able to call 911 to let dispatchers know, but again, it was going to be a matter of minutes before anybody could get to the scene. And so they actually directed him to perform CPR until medics arrived. When officers were able to get there, they confirmed that the subject was unconscious, no pulse. One officer was able to get a mobile artificial defibrillator device from her vehicle. She gave one shock to the subject, returning his pulse. Medics then arrived on scene, took over CPR. The man, who was described as in his late 20s, was taken to a local hospital for continued care. And if it weren't, again, for that bystander who, A, saw the unconscious individual and then was able to at least to try to render aid until police arrived, I mean, it's very likely that this individual would not have survived. So again, in the right place at the right time, wasn't able to do the right thing. This anonymous Good Samaritan there in San Mateo, California, we thank you for your very, very good deed. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program today. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Mark Walters from Armed American Radio is going to be our guest on this Thursday edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Just a programming note, we will be off on Monday for the Memorial Day holiday, but we may end up doing a program next Friday as well, just to keep the number of shows there the same that you normally get every week. And hopefully we won't have any more breaking news like we did last Friday when we had a special edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company with Costas Moros talking about the new lawsuits filed against Virginia's ban on so-called assault firearms. If we do have any sort of breaking news, I'm hoping it's good news out of like the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and we would have a circuit court split on the issue of the constitutionality of bans on commonly owned firearms like the AR-15 and magazines that can hold more than 10 rounds. But I'm not holding my breath. We get the Third Circuit decision when we get it. It's been more than 6 months. I'm not going to get my hopes up that we're going to get a decision anytime soon. We do also, though, still have the Wolford versus Lopez case and U.S. versus Amani. Supreme Court going to issue its opinions in those cases in the next couple of weeks. So we are keeping an eye out for any opinion day from the Supreme Court, and we could get a decision in those cases at any time. So we're keeping an eye on that as well. But tomorrow, again, we'll be talking with Mark Walters from Armed American Radio. Hope you can be a part of that. Make sure you're checking out BearingArms.com throughout the day today, keeping you up to date on all the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And if you like what you see, if you appreciate coverage like today's conversation with ATF Director Robert Sakata, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. All you have to do, go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code FIGHT, and you can take 60% off your membership. No matter what tier of support you choose, you're going to get some great benefits. Obviously, those benefits accrue as you move from a VIP to VIP Gold to VIP Platinum. One of the benefits for our VIP Gold and Platinum members, a weekly live chat. Going to be doing that at 1:30 Eastern today with Hot Airs at Morrissey. We'd love for you to be a part of this week's program or next week's live chat. Again, just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code FIGHT. Get 60% off your membership. And I want to thank you for your support. Have a great rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.